You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 387, our 47th Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Pretty good. Although I've been a little, I've spent more time at doctor's offices this year than my whole life up to this point.
Oh, you falling apart?
Yeah. No, I don't think I'm falling apart. I've got some back issues. I've got some gastrointestinal issues. So it's just these things are irritants right now. But so I've had kind of one of those weeks, but you know, it is what it is.
Nothing major, well, though, right?
You know, no, I mean, not that I know of or not that I've been told. So just one of those things that becomes a part of life that just nags you.
Yeah.
But it's new, so you asked, you know.
Yeah, no, that's true. I did. But you'll have to let us know. Now I'm worried. So now you got everybody worried, Mike. Everybody that just heard that is worried. So you're going to have to keep us informed.
All right, I'll keep. There'll probably be more updates to that than there are to the did Mike go in the pool question. But
yeah,
so yeah.
Well, I'm rattled now, Mike. Yeah, I got.
Yeah, well, think about the pugs. Pugs in the pool. That'll help.
All right, Mike. Well, I don't know how to turn. That's just bringing me down. I got to transition into some questions here because. Now you're making me think about my own health and just like, oh my gosh, I got to go to the doctor. But it's a downer, Mike. It's a downer. I don't appreciate you bringing that up.
Do we have like a Sheol question in here?
Yeah.
It'd be a good transition.
Seriously. No, all we got is our first question, Mike. And it's about Ezekiel 3:17-21. And Jordan says, I often hear pastors quote passages like Ezekiel 3:17-21 to try and motivate Christians to evangelize more often. Does this passage actually show that for at least some unbelievers out there, if someone witnesses to them, they would believe the gospel and go to heaven? But if no one witnesses them, they would go to hell. In other words, is their fate my fault?
Yeah, this question sort of... Well, it almost, it's going to sound a little odd, but it reflects kind of a poor theology of God. And that might sound, like I said, a little bit odd, but let me try to unpack it. I'll just say, first of all, I don't see how the passage applies specifically to evangelism at all. And I should probably read it, you know, just so people are aware of what it is we're talking about here. So this is Ezekiel 3:17. Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, you shall give them warning from me. If I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way in order to save his life, that wicked person shall die for his iniquity. But his blood I will require at your hand. But if you warn the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness or from his wicked way, he shall die for his iniquity. But you will have delivered your soul. So it's the watchman passage. Again, some people probably kind of knew where this was, you know, angling for right away, but it's good to just read it. The passage doesn't specifically apply to evangelism if we want to read it in context anyway. So, you know, there's that. And, you know, God doesn't, why would we think God puts all his eggs into one basket? You know, God is not so inept to tie his own hands, as it were, you know, in regard to someone's salvation or even someone's repentance. What I mean by that is he's not going to bind something he desires. God is not going to bind something he desires, the salvation of a lost person, to one Christian's obedience. Why would we even think that? It's like, you know, do we really believe that God says, oh, too bad that one Christian failed. You're toast now. You know, we're done here. You're welcome to hell. I mean, really? I mean, is this how we think about God's interest in humanity? That you know, any person's, you know, destiny, their eternal destiny is tied to one individual Christian and perhaps one encounter. And if there's a failure there, then there's no hope for that person. You know, I would suggest to you that if somebody's thinking that way, you should look back on your own life and realize that that isn't the way God drew you either. You know, it's never this one and done sort of thing. But that's why I said it kind of reflects poorly on the doctrine of God or what we how we think about God. Now, you know, I'll be more charitable here. You know, the thought at least counts. You know, a pastor who would be, you know, trying at least to preach from Ezekiel 3. You know, and okay, as an application, a point of application from Ezekiel 3, yeah, we should speak to lost people. But again, the circumstances here overstate the context of the passage for sure. And, you know, it could descend into something manipulative or at the very, maybe at, you know, I hate to say it this way, but at best, it's just teaching a theology that limits God, which is pretty bad. So what the passage means is actually answered in verse 17. Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. So there's the context. It's right in the verse. Now, some, you know, commentators like Dan Block, and we used his commentary a lot in our series on Ezekiel, take this statement as retrospective, sort of like, son of man, I made you, or I did make you, or I had made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Because Ezekiel, you remember, he's in Babylon. He's there with the captives. And so some scholars take it as the job that Ezekiel was doing before he himself was taken captive. So those who take this, you know, perspective would say that the words reflect what Ezekiel was doing before, you know, Jerusalem fell, before his own captivity. It's probably a better way to say it because Jerusalem's going to fall while he's in captivity. But this is what Ezekiel was supposed to be doing. He's doing the job of warning the people of Judah to repent. Now he's in Babylon with everybody else, and others say, you know, no, you know, it's not retrospective. Other commentators will say the wording here reflects his mission in Babylon. And honestly, this one actually makes more sense to me. And what it would be, the way we would understand is something like this. Ezekiel's message now that they're in Babylon, he's with this bunch of captives, is simply, don't defy God or you'll die. Just like the people I was warning back home before all this happened to us. So yeah, you know, Ezekiel was responsible for them back in the, you know, God's land. He was God's prophet. There were no other prophets among the captives by the Kibar Canal once they get into Babylon. So yeah, Ezekiel had a responsibility back home. He has a responsibility here. He's God's mouthpiece. You know, he was in his circumstances the only link that people had to God. So is it really fair though to put ourselves in that situation? Are you really the only person, you know, that is a person's link to, you know, the truth or something like that? It's kind of hard to say, you know, in a modern, especially American context. You know, Ezekiel, sure, he was speaking for God, so people better listen. If Ezekiel got lazy, then the people wouldn't get forewarned, and yeah, it would be his fault. But that's a little bit different than a Christian today. Though we all ought to speak for God, we all ought to, you know, play that role. But at the end of the day, we can't assume like we can for Ezekiel because we have Ezekiel 1 and 2 leading up to chapter 3. We can't assume that we're the only means by which a lost person will hear what they need to hear. But so what? We should still tell them anyway. I mean, it's our job to do evangelism. It's our job to do discipleship. It's our job to warn people when they're doing something self-destructive. You know, this is how you treat people well. But at the end of the day, to me, the real problem here is not applying this to evangelism. Okay, I'm fine with that if we tell our congregation what the passage actually meant in context and make it clear that this is an application. Fine. The real problem to me is how this trajectory ties God's hands as though, if you know, like God's depending on you so much that if you fail, then that person's eternal destiny is sealed and God's just had enough. God just, you know, stamped that guy's ticket to hell. That's absurd. That's absurd. You know, God is going to be interested in the lost because that's his nature. And he's going to, if you disobey, he's going to bring somebody else along. you know, he's going to still be trying to do what he, you know, wants to do, trying to get done what he wants to get done. And that is, you know, to save people from this destiny. I think it says far too much to sort of tie God's hands.
William was wondering if Mike would go over Psalm 139, highlighting verse 16. Looking at a parallel Bible online at about all possible verses, some add yet imperfect in the verse. Would this phrase, yet imperfect, make it more about David himself? And also, can you touch on the word Gollum?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I'll read Psalm 139:16. This is ESV. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. So if you compare translations here, they are going to differ. Some will say something like ESV has, my unformed substance. Others will use this imperfection language. And the alternatives really derive from the same place, the same Hebrew word, which the question included, this word Gollum. So if you actually look that up, you know, in a lexicon, the fundamental, you know, meaning to this is something like unformed or you know, not having shape, you know, shapelessness or something like that. So when a translator is looking at this, they could choose imperfect. In other words, it's imperfect. It's not what it's supposed to be because it's unformed. So they could choose between a word like imperfect or unformed, or they could, in the case of the question, they could actually loop them both into the translation to try to communicate the idea that what is being talked about here is not fully formed. It's not what it is destined to be. It's not what it's supposed to be or what it will be. So this idea is about the contents of the womb. Okay, it has nothing to do with, you know, David's father or mother or even David himself in a moral sense. It has to do with, hey, when I was conceived, I wasn't like fully conceived. And we know this. And an ancient person would know this because, you know, they did have, you know, stillborn children, or they did have, you know, miscarriages. Or again, a woman, you know, could be, you know, killed in battle or something like that, and then the contents of her womb exposed or something like that. Or again, you know, this, you know, a miscarriage situation. They know what the inside of a woman's womb looks like at, you know, basically all stages or various stages, anything you can see with a naked eye anyway. And so they know that when a child is conceived in the womb, it's not like it's going to look when it's birthed. Okay. And that's what the verse is talking about, and Gollum actually reflects that. So the Net Bible, again, which I want to recommend, I you know, it has a nice succinct note here. Net Bible is a free resource. I highly recommend it because it'll get into stuff like this. It says here, Hebrew behind, you know, your eyes saw my shapeless form. The Hebrew noun Gollum occurs only here in the Old Testament. In later Hebrew, the word refers to, quote, a lump, a shapeless or lifeless substance, unquote, or to, quote, unfinished matter, such as in a vessel wanting finishing or that needs to be completed or finished, unquote. And they cite here Jastrow, and this is Jastrow's, he has a lexicon. And I think this actually you could get for free online because it's an older resource. I think you can get this in PDF. I actually have it in Logos, which I of course recommend because of the searchability. But again, Jastrow, but here's the entry for Gollum. I'm looking at it right now. And like the Net Bible note says, you know, shapeless mass, you know, lump or shapeless or lifeless substance, that sort of thing. It is interesting that the word will be used for anything that's sort of unfinished or that needs to be completed, you know, more broadly than the contents of a woman's womb. So Net Bible brings up the example of a vessel. You have here he quotes, you know, something rabbinic about the word being used for an unmarried woman being a quote unquote unfinished vessel. Well, you know, obviously an unmarried woman who's long out of the womb, you know, is physically complete, but in the culture, she's not complete because she doesn't have a husband yet, doesn't have her own family, so on and so forth. So there's a little bit of a use of the term there for something more abstract. So something that isn't completed yet is really the fundamental meaning here. Again, this has nothing to do with, you know, moral character or sinfulness or anything like that. It just refers to the fact that it's not what it's intended to be yet. It's not what's there. And so how translators communicate that idea is going to be, you know, it's going to vary. They could, you know, opt for something a little more succinct, like shapeless, or they could add imperfect to that, combining words. You know, this is what translations do. They just try to communicate what's actually there. The translation, I think here, let me just take a one look back at ESV just to see how they did this. You saw my unformed substance. A more dynamic rendering would be something like adding when I was in the womb. This is just for sake of illustration. I'm not thinking of any particular translation, but even though the words when I was in the womb aren't in the verse, a translator could add that just to clarify what's going on. But again, translations differ. This is why, because the effort is to try to communicate something specific, or at least as specific as can be communicated. It's going to come down to translation philosophy. If your translation thinks that their job, that the translator thinks their job is word for word correspondence and no more, well, then you're going to get something like unformed with no elaboration. If they're looking at something that's more the translation philosophy is dynamic equivalent, where we can use however many words we need to in English to communicate the idea, well, you know, then you're going to have some elaboration.
Patrick wants to know, does the biblical numerology and name codes indicate that the writers made events up to fit theology? Or did these people in Numbers actually reflect reality?
Yeah, I'm not going to do it, but I would personally reword this question because I'm not sure what Patrick is specifically thinking of. When he talks about name codes, I have to guess that he's thinking of gematria. We just had this with 666, of course, in the Revelation series. Biblical numerology, you know, okay, gematria is a form of that, but there are other things going on with numbers. So I'm not specifically sure what he's angling for, but let's just go with gematria here. I would say that when gematria is actually used, which is rare in the Bible, the circumstances and people are real or intended as real. And when I say intended as real, I'm talking about like with eschatology or some conditional statement. In other words, there's like in the 666 thing, the number's given, it's the number of a name, it's a mark, so on and so forth. Well, it's describing a person yet to come. So the description is intended to convey a thought about a real person, but he's not real yet because he's not here yet, because we're talking about eschatology. That's all I'm saying about intended as real. So when the Bible does use gematria, it is trying to communicate something specific, either in some episode or about some real person, or again, projecting out in the future some circumstance that will come to pass. So there's no necessary contrivance or irreality that is necessarily tied to the use of gematria. Let's pick another example. Maybe it'll illustrate it a little bit better. And again, gematria is rare, but there are these that I think are pretty reasonable. In the case of the Gospels, the 153 fish, you know, after this post-resurrection appearance, when the disciples, you know, encounter Jesus again, and this is the very famous episode, but John actually gives us the number of the fish they caught, 153. Like, what did you just get out and count them? Or how do we know this is real time? Well, in that case, he could just be using gematria to communicate a specific idea, but the people about whom he is relating the idea are real people. My view is that the 153 fish, and I don't know if I've actually written about this or not. I use this in my second novel. But the 153 fish by gematria can be spelled out as sons of God. And so, you know, when Jesus repeats, you know, he reiterates that I'm, you know, making you fishers of men, you know, and we have this account where the disciples now, the relationship's restored with Peter and, you know, all this sort of stuff going on, this post-resurrection appearance, you would use this to communicate the idea that you are my children. We're still in relationship, and now you're tasked with going out and finding other children of God. Basically, it's the Great Commission. Well, that it's a cryptic gematria way of referring to these ideas, but they're spoken in a real circumstance to real people, the disciples. We know Peter and Jesus were real. Okay, so that for that reason, the question, I think, kind of connects two things: irreality and gematria unnecessarily. Another episode. I personally think that at the baptism of Jesus, the reference to the dove is probably gematria. The 153 fish you'll find in commentaries. The thing with the reference to the dove, that's a little more obscure. You're not really going to pick that up in too many commentaries, or I don't know any. I just came across that idea from a different source. And the issue is that the gospel writers use a particular word for dove, peristeron, when they could have used other words for, you know, another word for a dove, or a, you know, some neutral word that could be any bird or whatever. But peristeron is the one used, and it, by gematria, the letters in peristeron add up to the same total as the first two letters of the Greek alphabet, Alpha, Omega. So here you have at Jesus' baptism a sign from the Holy Spirit that the one being baptized is the Alpha and the Omega. Again, I just don't think that's a coincidence. It really suggests to me that there is some of this kind of communication going on. But again, it's Jesus. He's real. He was really baptized. So the connection with irreality is not a necessary one, or in these cases, even a coherent one.
Mark in Irvine, California, has our next question, and it is, if the fallen angels that fell before the flood are in prison under the earth, then where is Satan and the fallen angels now? Were there two separate falls? Also, was Satan the leader of the fallen angel rebellion before the flood? Why are some in prison now, and how does that explain fallen angels and Satan on the earth now?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to answer this question with the answer that's probably creeping into the minds of thousands of people listening to this, and that is, read the demons book. I mean, all of this is dealt with there in detail. So I'm not going to repeat all that information here, but the short form is, Satan is the Lord of the dead, the underworld. So that's his, if we can use this phrase, that's his living space now, as it were. That's where he was, you know, banished. At his own rebellion, you know, back in the garden. He can come and go as he wants. Yes, there were separate falls. Okay, there are really three falls, three rebellion events is a better way to put it. In Genesis 1 through 11, that explains evil in the world and in the biblical worldview, so on and so forth. So, yep, there are separate falls. There's no indication in the Bible that Satan had anything to do with the Watcher rebellion or the rebellion of Genesis 6, 1 through 4. There's no verse that ever says that. Now, there are reasons to conclude that Satan would be perceived hierarchically as the rebel par excellence, or the archetype, or the rebel that gets the most street cred among all other rebels. You know, that there's a reason why he's sort of talked about or cast in certain passages as having preeminence over the other ones. And again, read the demons book for all that. Now, I will say, First Enoch flirts with the idea of Satan having some role in the Watcher Genesis 6 rebellion, because the leader of that group in First Enoch is referred to, well, by several names, but two of them are Asael and Azazel. They're used interchangeably for the lead watcher. Now, those two terms become terms that are applied to Satan and the domain of Satan being the wilderness, the place that's un-Eden, the place that's anti-Eden, the place that is antithetical to what Eden was in biblical thought. But again, all the details for this are in the demons book as to why these thoughts would be sort of chained together in Second Temple Judaism, and how they sort of seep into the New Testament in certain places, at least a few of the ideas later on.
All right. Becky has a question about 1 Samuel 27, 8 through 10. When David was killing Philistines and telling Achish otherwise, was he possibly working under a harem idea of continuing to wipe out those directed by God to exterminate?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's an interesting question. You know, certainly Israelite readers of, you know, 1 Samuel 27, in this case, this is the Achish, you know, situation. Certainly Israelite readers would have connected those dots because of Joshua 11. If you recall Joshua 11, around verse 22, says that there's, Joshua proclaims victory by saying, there's no more Anakim in the land. Well, except for the ones that got away and went to the Philistine cities, you know, and he lists a few Philistine cities. Of course, one of them is Gath, and that's where we find Goliath later, Goliath the Gittite. He's one from Gath, of course, his brothers. And so, you know, anyone who's aware of that story, or if in scripturated form, in written form, if they had read the story, they're going to be thinking along these lines, because some of the Anakim wind up in Philistine territory, and lo and behold, Goliath and his brothers are giants, okay? Now, the text never actually explicitly makes that connection, though, even though it's sort of understandable how someone's mind would go there. So I think, at least with respect to Goliath and his brothers, again, because they're giants, the idea is probably legit, you know, that this is part of the picture of, you know, David's conflicts with the Philistines. It's a reasonable supposition, even though, again, the text doesn't spell it out specifically. But 1 Samuel nowhere uses the harem vocabulary generally of conflicts with the Philistines. So you can't just say that they were thinking this with respect to all of the Philistines, but certainly if you have a few giants kind of stumble onto the battlefield, okay, you know, it's the Anakim again, here we go. You know, again, it's a reasonable supposition. Now, 1 Samuel does use harem vocabulary for the Amalekites. And this is 1 Samuel, let's see, I think it's chapter 9. Let me just take a quick look here. So in 1 Samuel, like 14, 48, you get the Amalekites mentioned. But in chapter 15 is when you have a kind of an important passage with respect to this question. So you have here 1 Samuel 15. I'll just read a couple of verses here. Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction." There's the harem vocabulary, all that they have. Okay, so you have this language used specifically of the Amalekites. And if you remember in our series on Exodus, this is episode 283, the Amalekites more broadly than just the Philistines, okay, because again, this language isn't used broadly of the Philistines, but it is used of the Amalekites. The Amalekites descended from a giant clan. Okay, and you can go listen to Naked Bible Podcast episode 283. And they were cursed under Moses. So they, as a clan, you know, as a people group, they have roots in terms of where they come from to, again, one of the people groups back in that are associated with the conquest, that are specifically associated with giantism. Okay, the connection's there in the case of the Amalekites, but it's not specifically there in the case of the Philistines, except for, again, the vestiges of the Anakim that fled there. So I think that's why there's a difference in the vocabulary here between these two people groups. But, you know, even having said that, like I said, I think for Goliath and his brothers, yeah, you know, this is probably a legitimate trajectory of thought with respect to the whole enterprise of Harem, because it was about eliminating the giant clans in the first place. Here you have some vestiges among the Philistines, and so, yeah, it kind of fits. It kind of makes sense there.
Harem. Ham.
Like you're going to spit.
Yeah. Ham. All right, Mike. And just like that, short and sweet one, that's all we got for this week. We appreciate everybody sending in their questions. And Mike, for you answering those questions. Well, stay healthy, eat your vegetables, and get plenty of sleep, because right. I have a feeling. What time do you normally go
to? Yeah, I'm a night owl.
Yeah, me
too. I'm a night owl.
Yeah, all right. All right. Well, eat your Wheaties and stay healthy for the so we don't have to worry about you. Well, with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.